across the state of Minnesota, where you learn a lot. Charlie Mitchell sitting in for John Latimer. News is next. It's 5 o'clock.
This might be a familiar pain, but it hurts all the same. Every time. We cannot keep living our lives like this.
This hour, the latest from Michigan, after a man crashed his truck into a church yesterday and opened fire on people inside.
For Monday, September 29th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. New questions emerge a year after a massive fire at a chemical plant near Atlanta.
They don't look for the full spectrum of chemicals. I say you can't find what you don't look for, then they declare everything safe.
Also, former CIA analyst David McCloskey is out with a new spy thriller, which starts with a surprise attack by Israel on Iran.
Once you have the bones of that story, it's almost like you don't need to make anything up. It's like the Israelis and the Iranians have already written the bones of an insane spy novel.
And what are retail companies getting wrong when trying to appeal to Gen Z consumers?
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. After a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, President Trump outlined a peace plan to end the war in Gaza. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, it's not a done deal yet.
The plan calls for the release of the hostages, demilitarization of Gaza, and rebuilding overseen by a board of peace led by Trump.
We're right there. We're right there. First time in thousands of years, I think you can probably say, if you really look into it.
Trump said he has the backing of leaders in the region and, quote, I'm hearing that Hamas wants to get this done.
Israel would have my full backing to finish the job of destroying the threat of Hamas, but I hope that we're going to have a deal for peace.
Netanyahu offered qualified support. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
The country is heading towards a government shutdown unless a funding deal can be struck by the end of tomorrow. Congressional leaders from both parties met with President Trump today. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer says there are still large differences over health care and Trump's power to claw back funding.
I think for the first time, the president heard our objections and heard why we needed a bipartisan bill.
Republicans propose keeping government funding mostly at current levels. Senate Republican leader John Thune called Democrats' efforts a hostage taking.
The Republicans are united. House Republicans, Senate Republicans, President Trump. The House has passed a clean funding resolution to fund the government till November the 21st. It's clean, it is bipartisan, and it is short term.
During the last shutdown standoff earlier this year, Schumer and a small group of Democrats broke ranks to let the funding bill advance to a final vote. The Democratic leader has faced fierce backlash for the decision. Drug companies could be out of time to meet the Trump administration's demands for lowering prescription drug prices. NPR's Sydney Lupkin reports the administration gave them a deadline that ends today.
The Trump administration sent letters to 17 drug companies this summer to get them to reduce their prices in the U.S. The idea was for U.S. prices to match what people pay in other developed countries. The letters ask for lower Medicaid prices, prices for new drugs in line with what other countries pay, and direct-to-consumer options. And if drug makers didn't comply, the administration threatened to deploy every tool in its arsenal to make it happen. Some companies took action. AstraZeneca, for one, says it will offer its type 2 diabetes drug Farxiga directly to consumers at a discount. But so far, there haven't been sweeping price reductions. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
Wall Street ticked higher today as technology stocks recovered some of their losses from late last week. The S&P 500 added 0.3%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 68 points, or 0.1%. From Washington, this is NPR News. Authorities in the Bahamas have closed a majority of schools, and there are mandatory evacuations for some islands in the archipelago as Tropical Storm Imelda drops heavy rain and unleashes flooding in the northern Caribbean. Heavy rains are forecast along the coastline of North and South Carolina, too. Meanwhile, Hurricane Humberto is churning nearby. President Trump has threatened to impose 100% tariffs on movies that are made outside of the United States. As NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, it's not the first time the president has expressed this goal.
Back in May, Trump said that movies made, quote, in foreign lands were a national security threat. His latest statement folded in an attack on the governor of California. On Truth Social, Trump said, quote, our movie-making business has been stolen from the United States of America by other countries, just like stealing candy from a baby, end quote. He called California's Governor Newsom weak and incompetent and said 100% tariffs would solve what the president called a long-time, never-ending problem. The statement was part of a flurry of posts on a variety of issues, including the NFL and domestic furniture production. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
An experimental medication made from marijuana successfully reduced back pain, according to a new study. The 800-patient trial by German drug maker Vertanical offers further support for the drug's potential to treat chronic pain. Health officials in Canada and Europe have previously approved a pharmaceutical-grade form of cannabis for several types of pain, but it's still illegal under federal law in the U.S. I'm Ryland Barton. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's 5:06. More national coverage from All Things Considered up next. We're going to learn about President Trump pressing Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to accept a new plan to end the war in Gaza. Learn about chronic wasting disease with the Minnesota chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers this Thursday from 5 to 8 at Cuyuna Brewing Company in Crosby. Temperatures overnight in the mid-50s to low 60s.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The second anniversary of the October 7th Hamas attacks on Israel is drawing closer. And today, President Trump rolled out a new plan that he said would end the conflict that has devastated Gaza since then. He was joined by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who said that he agreed to it, at least for now. The plan calls for a quick end to the fighting, the return of all hostages, and a new governance structure for Gaza that does not involve Hamas. But Netanyahu said he was ready to keep fighting if Hamas does not agree to all the terms. And Hamas has not yet publicly responded to the proposal. NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben joins us now with more. Hi, Danielle.
Hey there.
Okay, so let's start with this plan. What are some of the key features of it?
Well, there's a lot here. There are 20 points, and among those are a plan for governing Gaza. It would be headed by a committee of what the plan calls qualified Palestinians and international experts. And that committee itself would be overseen by what's called a Board of Peace, which would be chaired by President Trump. And like you said, Hamas would have no role in this. Mm-hmm. Besides that, all hostages still held by Hamas would be returned. And in turn, Israel would return a number of prisoners and detainees that it has been holding. Beyond that, Gaza would be opened up to aid, and that is important given the dire need for food and medical supplies there.
Right. And who exactly would pay for Gaza to recover? I mean, after 2 years of military strikes there.
Well, there would be what the plan calls a Trump economic development plan to rebuild and energize Gaza. Now, we don't know more about what that would look like, but this is something Trump has had on his mind before. You'll recall that earlier this year, Trump shared an AI-generated video of a kind of a Gaza that looked a lot like a resort, complete with businesses called Trump Gaza. But again, we don't know what this would look like. But aside from all that, the Israeli military would progressively withdraw from the area, eventually leaving a security buffer zone, it says, around the Gaza region. And that would remain in place until, again, what the plan says is until Gaza is properly secure from any resurgent terror threat.
Okay. Well, what happens, Danielle, if Hamas does not agree to any of this or some of it?
Well, Trump said he thinks Hamas is on board and his team has been working with Qatar, a key intermediary, to make this happen. In fact, today he got Netanyahu to phone the Prime Minister of Qatar during their meeting to apologize for recent strikes on Hamas leaders who were in Qatar. But again, Trump was blunt today. He said if Hamas does reject this plan, the U.S. will back Israel.
If Hamas rejects the deal, which is always possible, they're the only one left. Everyone else has accepted it. But I have a feeling that we're going to have a positive answer. But if not, as you know, Bibi, you'd have our full backing to do what you would have to do.
And similarly, Netanyahu, he had a slightly different way of putting it, but nevertheless threatening.
But if Hamas rejects your plan, Mr. President, or if they supposedly accept it and then basically do everything to counter it, then Israel will finish the job by itself. This can be done the easy way, or it can be done the hard way, but it will be done.
The easy way or the hard way. Okay, well, Danielle, what are the biggest sticking points right now to this plan actually working?
Well, Palestinian statehood stands out. One of the last points in this plan is a pledge to look for a pathway to a Palestinian state, but there are preconditions here. First of all, that redevelopment, economic redevelopment must be underway, and also that the Palestinian Authority, which is the internationally recognized Palestinian leadership in the West Bank, mm-hmm. that must reform itself. And then, after all that, conditions may finally be in place for a pathway to statehood. So it's a lot of conditions and nothing certain. Really, this plan just raises a lot of questions. And point notably, the president and prime minister did not take questions from reporters today. Now, that's partially because President Trump had to meet with congressional leaders about a potential shutdown. But it also means he didn't have to answer tough questions about how all of this would work.
That is NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben at the White House. Thank you, Danielle.
Of course. Thank you.
It's been a year since a massive fire at a chemical plant near Atlanta produced a plume of toxic smoke that remained for days. Federal reports point to safety lapses inside the plant, but new questions are also being raised about the response. Pamela Kirkland with Georgia Public Broadcasting has been following the aftermath in the podcast Manufacturing Danger and brings us this update.
The 911 call came in at 5 a.m. on September 29th last year.
Rockdale County 911, how can I help you?
We got a freaking head bust, a biolab, there's chemical smoke everywhere.
Biolab is one of the nation's largest producers of pool and spa chemicals, like chlorine tablets. The toxic plume from the fire drifted across majority black Rockdale County, forcing evacuations and shelter-in-place orders. In Atlanta, 20 miles away, people noticed a haze and a sharp chlorine odor. For longtime residents near the plant, this wasn't the first time.
In 2004, we only saw gray and black clouds. This one, we've seen pink, we've seen black, we've seen beige.
The company has had five major accidents over 20 years. Gene Sadler has lived through all of them.
You hear a siren coming our way and you think, oh my God, what's going on?
She's now part of a class action lawsuit brought by residents who are reporting health issues they say are stemming from the fire. The U.S. Chemical Safety Board is still investigating, but has already said reactive materials came in contact with water, which triggered at least two fires. They also found that the sprinkler system had corrosion, like salt water eating away at metal, and had been leaking in the weeks before the fire.
When I first saw the fire, I assumed it was the leaky sprinklers because it was a constant issue.
Randy Garcia left Biolab 5 months before the accident. He was the on-site engineer and says he had been replacing corroded sprinkler heads until the day he quit. Residents now have questions about exactly what chemicals were released in the fire. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency monitored the air right afterwards and found unsafe chlorine levels near the plant, mostly overnight. The rest of the county showed acceptable levels. But residents now say their testing wasn't enough. They brought in their own tester, Scott Smith, known for his work after the 2023 East Palestine train derailment in Ohio. He says the EPA wasn't thorough enough in their monitoring.
They don't look for the full spectrum of chemicals. I say you can't find what you don't look for, then they declare everything safe.
Smith says his sampling found dangerous chemical byproducts, dioxins and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. An EPA spokesperson said in an email that it takes concerns about its emergency response seriously, but did not respond to Smith's specific findings. Biolab declined to respond to this story. The company disputes any federal finding from the Chemical Board investigation so far, but says it is still cooperating. Biolab also faces a federal lawsuit from the county. In May, the company said it will no longer make pool chemicals in Conyers, but will continue to use the facility to store and distribute its products. After five fires in 20 years, Jean Sadler wants none of it near her house.
You work so hard all of your life to obtain just a living. And then it's things like this it's nothing I can do about that would drain you.
The Chemical Safety Board says its investigation could take another 6 months. For NPR News, I'm Pamela Kirkland in Conyers, Georgia.
You could find out more about the history of the company and the aftermath of the chemical fire in the podcast Manufacturing Danger, the Biolab Story from GPB.
It is Fat Bear Week at Katmai National Park and Preserve in Alaska. Every fall, the online competition celebrates how fat the bears have gotten in preparation for months of hibernation. As Alaska Public Media's Ava White reports, people are tuning in from way beyond Alaska to see who will be crowned the chubby champ.
Last year, over a million people voted for their favorite fat bear, according to the National Park Service. One of them is Robin Keegan, an elementary school teacher in Richmond, Virginia. Every year, her school pulls up the live streams of the bears fishing, fighting, and sleeping in the national park for the students to watch.
It is people's escapism. I think it heals our hearts in lots of ways to have this thing that's far away from all of us that we're all bonding over and all rooting for.
The school pulls out all the stops with bear-themed games and activities, like letting students measure themselves beside a life-size brown bear cutout. Keegan says that a lot of her students don't have much access to wilderness.
For them to, like, imagine that there's these spaces that are open where things are allowed to be wild is fascinating to watch them realize that.
Bears, especially the brown bears up there, are just awesome.
Jeff Hartley works at a church in northwestern Arkansas and was wearing a T-shirt saying, "I'm ready for Fat Bear Week," when we spoke on Zoom. Each year, he prints the 12 bear bracket and passes them out to his congregation to fill out. Whoever has the most accurate bracket wins a bear-themed prize. He says he loves that it brings people together.
It's a community. It's a place to get together with people all over the world, different backgrounds. But, you know, we all love fat bears. We all love rooting for the bears, cheering them on.
Hartley cheers for the same bear each year, number 32, or Chunk. Chunk is one of the largest bears at the Brooks River, weighing in at a whopping 1,200 pounds plus, and was last year's runner-up. Olivia Broncho, meanwhile, says picking a favorite is too hard.
I don't have a bracket because I feel like it's a disservice to the fatness of the other bear, so I never vote. I am just happy that the bears are being fed.
The Alaskan now lives in Rome, Italy, and says watching the competition is a way to connect with home. Fat Bear Week ends Tuesday. You can vote online at explore.org. For NPR News, I'm Ava White in Anchorage.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 5:18. More news coming up next from a national perspective, all things considered. At 5:30, we bring you the Up North Report. You can also catch local news at our website right now at kexe.org, including a story on appeals court reinstating of a pipeline protester's excessive force lawsuit. This was happening in Hubbard County. It was a federal lawsuit that alleged that law enforcement there used excessive force and violated the constitutional rights of a Line 3 protester that has been reinstated. Also, you've got music news there, as well as a story about the Vinshuti Wildlife Sanctuary, where they feed the bears so that you do not. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for tuning in today. We received support from the state of Minnesota. We'd also like to thank Rapids Brewing Company. They're a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsco.com. Itasca County Public Health is offering a flu vaccine clinic this Thursday from 4 to 6 at the Itasca Resource Center in Grand Rapids for those with and without insurance. No appointments are necessary. And the Minnesota Department of Transportation has an open house tomorrow from 4 to 6 at Park Rapids City Hall. You can learn about Highway 71 corridor study. There will not be a formal presentation, so you may come and go as you wish. Also going on, Kutaska Community Action in Grand Rapids is collecting gently used Halloween costumes now until October 15th at the site of the former Murphy Elementary building, 9 to 4 on weekdays. This week, our question of the week is about grocery stores. Do you have a story to share about the grocery store in your community when you were growing up? Text us 218-326-1234.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV. With new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at Schwab.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A major challenge for writers of espionage fiction is, what happens if your plot gets overtaken by events? Like, what happens if you write a novel where the villain is Russian and the action's all in Moscow, and in the meantime, war breaks out with China? And that's where everyone's attention is focused. Well, our next guest has the opposite problem. David McCloskey keeps writing spy thrillers, and the plots keep coming true. David, welcome back.
So glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
I will open by reminding people that in real life, war between Israel and Iran broke out this past summer in June. Israel launched a surprise attack, assassinated Iranian military leaders and scientists. Your new novel, The Persian, opens with Israel having just launched a surprise attack and they've just assassinated an Iranian military leader and a scientist. When did you come up with this story?
Well, I came up with this story well before the most recent sort of round between Israel and Iran. And unlike my last novel, where I wrote a Russia-focused story basically in the middle of Vladimir Putin invading Ukraine, this time I did not have time to go back and change the story. The book was already written and being printed during the conflict this summer. But the book really tries to kind of scrape beneath the kind of overt conflict and get into the heart of the shadow war between Israel and Iran.
Well, I was going to ask you about this because when I last interviewed you, we were talking about one of your previous books, Moscow X, set in Russia, and you were telling me how as you were writing, Russia had launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine and you had to redo all kinds of things. This time you just had to white-knuckle through it and figure it's going to be what it's going to be, and this is fiction?
Well, that's right. And I was at least somewhat encouraged this time that, you know, I think the guts of the shadow war, not necessarily the kind of overt military conflict, are really at the heart of this story. And I really did try to take actual chapters from this conflict between Tel Aviv and Tehran and embed them, you know, in kind of a fictionalized way into the book. So, for example, a few years ago, the Israelis assassinated the head of Iran's nuclear program using a remote-operated robotic machine gun. Mm-hmm. And that, in effect, is the sequence that opens this novel, The Persian, although, of course, you know, the characters in some of the places have been changed. So this is a case much like Russia, where the actual news, the actual conflict, provides so much fodder for spy novelists kind of seeking to dig around in this terrain.
All these details that you couldn't make it up if you tried. You're a former CIA analyst, for people who don't know that. You were posted at stations across the Middle East. How much of that inside knowledge shows up in this fiction?
A lot of it, I would say. I mean, I dug up characters who are, you know, real intelligence officers, or at least I'm trying to depict them as authentically as possible.
Well, and CIA censors, I'll call them, the Publication Review Board, they're required to review everything you publish as a former CIA staffer, right?
That's right,
I mean, I was surprised at some of the details that are in here, and I thought, I don't know if he's making this stuff up.
Yeah, you know, I send every draft through the what we call our publication review board. And, you know, I'm oftentimes, frankly, a little bit surprised at what can get through. But in this case, you know, I think there's so much that's actually, in particular on that type of, you know, on this kind of drones, or frankly, these types of intelligence operations that Mossad conducts in this realm of the shadow war, there actually is a lot out there that you can, you know, as a novelist, you can kind of get the bones of the story And this is where, much like Russia, the reality is almost stranger than fiction. So once you have the bones of that story, it's almost like you don't need to make anything up. It's right. Like the Israelis and the Iranians have already written the bones of an insane spy novel. And frankly, at times, I was tempted to tone it down so my editor wouldn't think I was making anything up that's too crazy.
Were there any calls that went the other way? A detail you thought was completely innocuous that the CIA review board was like, delete, delete, delete?
Yeah, so they deleted a reference to an instant messaging program used at the CIA.
Hang on, are you allowed to tell us this if they told you you couldn't publish
it? I'm not going to give you the name of the program.
Okay.
It wasn't that the CIA uses an instant messaging capability. It was the specific name of the vendor, right, that provides that. And they deleted that, presumably because the contract is classified or some such.
Right.
But then they left in, of course, relatively granular detail on how to construct an improvised explosive device. So it's oftentimes hard for this novelist to know exactly what will be redacted.
You, I believe it was chapter 18, and you open it with something fascinating to me. You note that for most of its modern history, Israel has not had diplomatic relations with its near neighbors, which means Mossad, their spy agency, has not been able to operate out of Israeli embassies in the way that the CIA or, say, Britain's MI6 do. And you write, and I'm quoting, "Instead, operational teams are cobbled together, surged to where they are needed, then disbanded when the work is done. The plane is built as it flies." Is that true? And if so, how does it impact Mossad tradecraft?
Yeah, it is true. And it was one of the very interesting pieces or sort of tidbits to come out of the conversations I had with Mossad officers while I was researching this book, which is because the Israelis have not typically had, or, you know, for much of their history, as that passage says, did not really have an embassy to use. It meant that the types of cover that had to be used to put officers into the location where they might conduct the operation has always been a bit more exotic in general than the types of cover that the CIA would use, where, you know, for much of our history, you'd have someone who works in an embassy who's under diplomatic cover. Mm-hmm. The Israelis aren't able to do that. So you have different types of cover. And you get the sense from interacting with a lot of these Mossad officers that when a problem is identified, a team is sort of put together to then deal with that problem. And that's a very different kind of mentality, I think, to intelligence work than what I experienced at the CIA. So mirror imaging the CIA onto Mossad just didn't work.
Hmm. So what is the thread of your next novel? Have you figured it out? And I guess I ask with some trepidation, given that we noted your fictional plots keep coming true.
Well, your trepidation might be well-founded in this case, Mary Louise, because it is a story set between Washington and London, and it is, again, set in the very real context of transatlantic relations today. And I started the book with the goal of putting as much stress on the special relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. as I could, and whether the sort of relationship could sour to the point where we're all spying on each other again.
You have whet my appetite for the next one and given us plenty to chew on in this one. David McCloskey, thank you.
Mary Louise, thanks so much for having me.
That's former CIA analyst David McCloskey. His latest espionage thriller is The Persian.
This is NPR News.
Local news from our region coming up next with the Up North Report. Let us know if there's some news going on in your region. You can send us a news tip. Send it to news@kaxe.org. Sunny skies today with highs 80 to 84. Light southwest winds. Partly cloudy with lows 54 to 60 tonight. And partly to mostly sunny tomorrow, 73 to 80 degrees. You can help shape the future of our cultural programming by taking a survey on our legacy shows. Find it at kaxe.org. Tomorrow at 10 a.m., Adventures in Lifelong Learning is continuing its fall season. at the Bemidji Eagles Club. Coffee and treats are served beginning at 9:40. A variety of speakers each week. Find the full schedule on Facebook. Fire in the Village is hosting the Creative Crow Club the first Wednesday of each month, beginning this Wednesday from 4 to 6 at Old Central School in Grand Rapids. Youth can explore their artistic gifts and find their voice and build a caring community.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. The Virginia Fire Department rescued two men after their falls down a 100-foot cliff Saturday. In a news release, the fire department says they responded to the Mesabi Bike Trail access in Virginia around 4:30 that afternoon and heard two men calling for help from a mine pit. One man was about 50 feet down, clinging to a cliff, and the other was about 100 feet down at the water's edge with reported injuries. Rescuers rappelled down the cliffside to reach the two men, with the first able to climb out with assistance. The second man was evacuated from the mine pit via boat and transported to Essentia Health Virginia for treatment of minor injuries. Multiple Minnesota outlets are reporting more possible fraud within the state's Department of Human Services. In a letter to state lawmakers, WCCO and the STRIB report that temporary DHS Commissioner Shireen Gandhi described stopping payments to 11 disability service providers earlier in September. The stop payments also impacted an additional 17 providers affiliated with the Integrated Community Supports Program. This is a Medicaid service that provides training and help to adults with disabilities who live in a provider-controlled setting, such as providing opportunities for community participation, health, safety, and wellness, household management, or adaptive skills. Gandhi described the program as filling the gap between a person living in their own home and more restrictive settings, such as a group home or assisted living. The fraud allegations accuse these providers of billing the state for services that were not provided. The move to suspend payments comes amid a backdrop of numerous federal investigations into the department, recently with suspected fraud within the Housing Stabilization Services Program, as well as the massive and still unfolding Feeding Our Future scandal. Northern Township is presenting its case to become a city this week during the first days of a two-week administrative trial. Northern Township is seeking to firm up its boundary against any further annexation by its nearest neighbor, the city of Bemidji. It plans to construct a new multi-million dollar wastewater treatment facility, securing nearly half of the cost with federal grant dollars and covering the rest with additional assessments on the property taxes of connected households. The township is also pursuing additional funds to cover the infrastructure through state bonding dollars, having been included on a 2023 bonding bill that never made it to the finish line. Next week, Bemidji will present its case to annex around Lake Bemidji. The city says it can get sewer and water around the lake connected to its already established systems at a lower connection cost to its ratepayers. The trial in Northern Township will take place all day Monday through Friday at its town hall, with a public hearing scheduled for 6 p.m. Tuesday at the Beltrami County Fairgrounds 4-H building. The trial in Bemidji will also be multiple days at City Hall next week, with a public hearing slated for 6 p.m. Wednesday, October 8th at the Sanford Event Center. State and federal agencies are working on a joint effort in the Chippewa National Forest to slow down the spread of emerald ash borer. The effort throughout September has involved the release of three species of non-stinging wasps to target the invasive borer at different life stages. The wasps are small and do not harm humans, and the USDA says it has tested to ensure the wasps won't impact other species in the forest. More than 5,000 were released into 200 acres of infested areas of the Chippewa National Forest this year, with nearly 4,000 released last summer. The state's Ag Department began releasing these types of wasps in 2010 to slow the spread of emerald ash borer, with the wasps released into 55 infested sites since. EAB was first detected in Minnesota in 2009 and is a growing concern to forest health experts, as Minnesota is home to an estimated 1 billion ash trees. Resurfacing of Highway 64 between Akeley and LaPorte began Monday. MnDOT says construction crews will resurface the highway using a micro-mill and thin-lay process, which will provide a smoother ride for drivers. Work is expected to be complete mid-October, weather permitting. Motorists can expect flagger and pilot car operations. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, morning show, and Phenology teams. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. yptc.com/NPR. And from Focus Features, presenting Anemone, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. Two brothers wrestle with their past and the one secret that has kept them apart for decades. Anemone, rated R, in theaters Friday. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Authorities now say four people were killed and eight wounded in the massacre on Sunday morning at a worship service of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Grand Blanc, Michigan. Officials say the accused shooter also used some sort of accelerant to start a fire in the church. Here's Township Police Chief William Rennie.
Evil. This was an evil act of violence. That's exactly what this was. And this is not Grand Blanc. This does not define Grand Blanc and who we are.
Joining us now with more is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
So I understand that you're near what remains of the church there. What are you seeing right now?
Well, authorities are using the parking lot and the grounds of a church right next door, a Jehovah's Witness Kingdom Hall, as a staging area for the investigation. They're neighbors to this LDS property that was attacked. The road is closed for about a quarter mile on either side of the church with yellow caution tape strung for blocks and blocks. In part, that's because authorities have been looking for possible improvised explosive devices. You can see just a tad of the burned building through the many, many law enforcement vehicles here from where I'm sitting, an ATF, FBI, sheriff's vehicles, police. And in the air, Elsa, when the breeze is just right, you can smell the smoke from yesterday's blaze that burned down this church.
Still lingering. Well, what is the latest information on the victim so far?
Authorities say five people total are dead, and that includes the alleged shooter, and there are eight people injured. Dr. Michael Danik is the medical chief of staff for Henry Ford Genesis Hospital nearby. He says victims range in age from just 6 years old to 78 years old. The injuries include both gunshots and smoke inhalation. Two of the victims remain in critical condition. The doctor said the six-year-old is not one of those in critical condition, but was treated and transferred to another medical facility. Dr. Danik said some medical residents from his own hospital are actually also LDS members who were at the church yesterday morning.
Not only were they victims, they were also first responders. They were heroes. Those on the scene were absolute heroes, going in and out of the fire to drag people out, helping each other take care of the victims on the scene.
And also, authorities have not yet released the victims' names, but they say everyone has been accounted for.
And Jason, can you talk about like how people from the community are responding to all of this now?
Well, you know, unlike other shootings where I've seen piles of flowers at the site of the attack, mm-hmm. I'm thinking just last month when we talked in Minneapolis,
yeah.
As of mid-morning today, only really, well, actually, I'm looking right now, just like three or four bouquets here in front of the church. And perhaps that's because it's harder to get to this site. There aren't just really sidewalks around here. There have been several attacks on houses of worship, though, in recent months, and something that Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer said today really struck me.
This might be a familiar pain, but it hurts all the same. Every time. We cannot keep living our lives like this.
Governor Whitmer is urging calm, and she cautions people not to jump to conclusions about motives for the attack.
And where does the investigation stand as of now?
Well, the FBI is calling this a targeted act of violence, and while the rhetoric from the White House yesterday and today has been that this was specifically an anti-Mormon attack, authorities here are not willing to say that yet.
Mm-hmm.
They've identified Thomas Jacob Sanford as the alleged shooter who rammed the car into the LDS church building, and they said the building was essentially burned to the ground now.
That is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose in Grand Blanc, Michigan. Thank you so much, Jason.
You're welcome.
Time is up for 17 drug makers that received letters from the Trump administration this summer. The letters gave the company 60 days to respond to the administration's demands to lower their prices. NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin is here to fill us in on what's happening. Hi, Sydney.
Hi, Scott.
So remind us, what does the administration want from these companies?
Yeah, the main goal is to lower the prices Americans pay for name brand drugs and put them in line with what other developed countries pay, which is typically a lot less. There was an executive order pushing that idea in May, but in August, the Trump administration wasn't satisfied with what it was hearing from the drug companies, so it sent letters to 17 of them with a list of demands. Lower prices in Medicaid, for example. Launch new drugs at prices that match what people in other countries are paying. Sell some drugs directly to consumers at lower prices. That said, this would all be voluntary, but the letters carried a threat, saying, quote, if you refuse to step up, we will deploy every tool in our arsenal to protect American families from continued abusive drug pricing practices.
So what have the companies done with this?
So I reached out to all 17 companies that got a letter. Most didn't respond to me or declined to comment. Others touted changes in press releases, like Bristol-Myers Squibb. It said it will offer its blood thinner Eliquis and a plaque psoriasis drug directly to consumers at a discount. It also says it will launch its new schizophrenia drug in the UK at the same price it is in the US, which, by the way, is almost $2,000 a month. So no savings there for Americans. But overall, it doesn't sound like the Trump administration got the pledges of widespread price reductions it was hoping for. Juliet Kubansky is a Medicare drug pricing expert at the nonpartisan research group KFF.
This administration has a habit of kind of setting deadlines and blowing past them without anything really happening.
She says now that the deadline is here, the administration might have to pivot to legislation or rulemaking to get what it wants.
So what is our sense at this moment about what this means for consumers?
It's going to take a little longer to figure that out. The companies may still do some things in response to the administration's pressure, and there are a few actions already, but they might not translate to lower prices at U.S. pharmacy counters. For example, after getting its letter in August, Eli Lilly said that it would raise the price of its type 2 diabetes drug, Mounjaro, in the U.K. And Lilly was clear in its announcement this was basically because of the Trump administration, but that doesn't necessarily mean the price will go down here in the U.S.
Then how do tariffs fit into all of this? Because that's been such a big theme of this year.
Mm-hmm. The Trump administration is trying all kinds of things at the same time. It's pushing to get drug companies to build factories in the U.S. by tariffing some drug imports starting next month. And that could raise prices. Steve Ubel, the CEO of the drug company trade group Pharma, wrote that its members committed to spending $500 billion on infrastructure in the U.S. over the next few years. But it's hard to know how the Trump administration's actions will play out because they're happening via executive order and public pressure. That's unlike legislation that gets scored by the Congressional Budget Office. In that case, you can see how much money it will cost or save taxpayers, and we just don't have that here.
Got it. That is NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin. Thank you so much.
You bet.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's been a year since remnants of Hurricane Helene walloped eastern Tennessee and western North Carolina with devastating and deadly flooding. Today, recovery is inching along, but you can see the challenges right on the Nolichucky River, a popular destination for white water rafters. NPR's Rolando Arrieta returned to see how the cleanup is going.
When Amelia Taylor learned outfitters near the Nolichucky would remain closed this season, she needed to make up the lost income. She went from being a professional whitewater river guide.
And now I'm a professional trash lady.
Taylor has been a river guide in the area for 16 years. She says picking up trash along the river is not terrible, despite the occasional bump, scrape, and bruise.
And in some ways, I honestly like this job more. I like to say the trash is easier to deal with than people.
And so with just me and a microphone to deal with, Taylor and her cleanup crew head down the Lower Nullichucky on big six-person rafts.
Oh, yeah. She's back in the flow now.
The garbage is piled so high, we can barely see the rapids ahead. Car parts, toys, household items, and lots of...
sheet metal, piece of somebody's roof. I'm going to kind of throw it. Don't be scared. I'm going to try not to pop the raft either. I'm going to just throw it kind of right here.
As we peel out of a netty and continue downstream, Taylor scouts the rapid up ahead.
This next part looks really challenging. We should have gone up that way, but I do need you to get your paddle in your hand. Let's go one forward. Two forward. Keep going forward.
Lily Johnson and her husband own a local rafting company. They bought it last year. 6 months later, Helene hit.
So we haven't had a second season of rafting like we, you know, pictured when we purchased the business.
Then a baby girl arrived. Johnson says while it's been an uncertain year, at least their building is still standing. So for now, they'll use their rafts and staff to clean up the river.
It gives us a chance to put our guides to work. They're still doing what they're trained to do in, you know, paddling down the river in a raft. And we're cleaning up our watershed so that it's ready for us when we're ready to get back out there.
And they're seeing progress. Guides like Taylor and dozens more are doing cleanup missions nearly every day. Helene's destruction throughout the Nullichucky Gorge was massive. Debris flow landslides hurled chunks of railroad tracks and hazardous material into the river. Trey Moore, a local paddler, teamed up with a few outfitters to form a nonprofit and work alongside local, state, and federal agencies to help the county's outdoor tourism, economic recovery, and river restoration.
And we were able to go and take care of the river that has always taken care of us.
The U.S. Forest Service hopes to reopen the river access points next spring. Moore says they have their work cut out for them. Guides need to be retrained. It's a new river with new rapids and new risks.
And so this destruction and fundamental change of this insanely large geologic event is an opportunity for a rebirth and an opportunity to reconnect with the river, with the community, and to heal.
Local paddlers have started to informally refer to the river as the Nullichucky. Rolando Arrieta, NPR News, Irwin, Tennessee.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 5:48. More news is coming up next from All Things Considered. It's here on People Powered KAXC. We are learning about a senior business writer at Variety. They're going to be talking about video game company called Electronic Arts. Stay tuned for that story. But first, let's thank ICTV. Stay tuned. Stay connected with ICTV. You can learn more at watchictv.org. Up next, a little musical break with Charlie Crockett.
Caught a plane out of Austin this morning in the drizzling rain. Blue bonnets line the highway sign, let me know it's spring. They want to put me in a TV show, I don't know if it's right. We'll be right back.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A new Nike ad asks kind of an existential question.
Why do it?
Why do it? The company famous for telling people to just do it is now asking, why even try?
Seriously, why? You could give everything you have and still lose.
Nike says it's targeting a new generation by addressing the fear of trying, the fear of failing, and the fear of earnest effort in a world of social media scrutiny, fear of being, as a Gen Zer might say, cringe. But does this kind of advertising reach its intended audience? Well, to help us answer that question, we turn to Casey Lewis. She writes the after-school newsletter about youth culture and trends. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, what did you make of the new Nike ad?
I mean, it's been a tough go for Nike over these last couple of years. They, for so long, really cornered the youth culture market. They were the pinnacle of cool. And then the last couple of years, not so much. But I think they're trying to, you know, lean away from this idea of perfection and, you know, pressure and hustle culture.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well then, if this is intended for younger people, like, what is the urgency for Nike to target young people? Were they not connecting with Gen Z, or are companies like Nike just generally anxious about their sales right now?
I think yes and yes. Adidas has very much dominated the top spot among young people in terms of cool sneakers. The Samba, the Campus, these have been like status sneakers among teens. There's a quarterly survey of teens' favorite brands, Piper Sandler. You know, Nike has for years been the number one brand in footwear. So they're not irrelevant, but they are no longer creating trends in the way that they once were. And I think they want that back.
So what are companies like Adidas getting right? Or what are other companies not like Adidas getting wrong when it comes to marketing to Gen Z?
What makes it hard to be a brand these days chasing cool is the teens are very much the ones setting the trends, and it's happening very quickly on social media. Now, one cool kid on TikTok can upload a video of himself wearing a pair of Adidas Sambas. That video can go viral, and then suddenly Sambas are selling out, and it really can happen that quickly. So Adidas really is just, they found themselves in a lucky position. Of course, they have history of creating amazing shoes, but a lot of it is the, you know, luck of the draw.
Okay, so if it's sometimes luck of the draw, I'm just thinking, if teens are the ones who are identifying what is cool first, how are companies responding to that? How are they shifting their marketing campaigns to adapt to that?
The companies that are able to respond the best to these young consumers are the ones that have built themselves to be able to respond quickly. One that comes to mind is Hollister, but they have really figured out how, you know, if this oversized sweatshirt is suddenly selling, they will introduce it in 15 different patterns and colors, you know, overnight. And, you know, that's a crazy thing for a company that's been around for so long to be able to figure out. And so it really just comes down to infrastructure, which isn't an easy answer. And, you know, it's not like on the marketing teams. It's a lot more complicated than that.
Quick-footed agility. That is Casey Lewis. She writes the after-school newsletter and studies Gen Z consumer trends. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
The tiny mountain kingdom of Lesotho is surrounded entirely by South Africa, and it has become plagued by gang violence related to a popular style of music known as FAMO. The government has even banned some FAMO groups in an attempt to stop the killings, as Kate Bartlett reports from the country's capital, Maseru.
That's Kopolo Godwe, one of Lesotho's most famous FAMO musicians. He was shot dead last year in a hit, another casualty of the FAMO gang wars roiling the country.
FAMO is a very difficult genre to explain, but in essence, it's poetry engraved in folklore. People in America or any other country would say it's hip-hop. It's a form of expression.
That's Lesotho music journalist Matsumai Makocho. Some in the Lesotho music industry have likened the situation to the East Coast-West Coast rivalry between hip-hop groups in 1990s that resulted in the murders of Tupac Shakur and the Notorious B.I.G.
There are some bars where you cannot play music from a certain group because you get killed.
Last year, Prime Minister Sam Matakane declared a war on FAMO, even going as far as calling some bands terrorists and banning certain blankets linked to musicians. In Lesotho, brightly coloured wool blankets are traditional dress. Men wear them draped around their shoulders and women pinned at the waist. Their patterns have meaning and rival gangs wear different ones. But it wasn't always this way. FAMO was born from gentle, pastoral origins. The accordion-based music was made by herders and shepherds as they wandered Lesotho's snow-capped mountain ranges with their animals. Later, the music found new life in South Africa, where Lesotho migrants worked Johannesburg's gold mines. In rowdy shebeens, taverns where miners drank after work, the music thrived. Men sung with accordion bass and a tin drum wrapped in rubber, while women danced, skirts flying. Kuseletso Siema broke through the gender barriers to make her own music, becoming known as the Queen of FAMO.
FAMO ki tansi ya Basotho.
She says she grew up in a very poor family and that her parents didn't have a son, so she had to take care of the animals. In the fields, she found her voice and began singing FAMO. She then made her way to Johannesburg, playing for mine workers and rising to stardom. Despite her popularity, the 77-year-old lives today in abject poverty.
Gogo, which is your famous song? Which one should I play?
It's 1, 2, 3.
Let's listen to you.
We watched some of her old videos together on YouTube on my phone.
And this song? What are you singing about in this one?
She says she has pain, pain in her heart. The grandmother doesn't want to comment on the current gang violence, but she does say she doesn't like music that is vulgar, insulting, or advocates hate. Despite the government crackdown, FAMO music is still the sound of Maseru. As we walk down the street, FAMO music blasts from a record store. Shop owner Pokona Manyane says he lives and breathes FAMO music. He's not sure why the different FAMO groups are fighting. He just really digs the music. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Maseru.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org.
Up next, it's the news from Canada. It is As It Happens. You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio that tells the stories of the people and the land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You can listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media, especially in lieu of federal funding cuts to all of public media. Text the word donate right now to 218-326-1234. Thanks to your amazing support, we have raised over $170,000. We cannot thank you enough. Keep it coming if you didn't get a chance to donate to us. We are in